This is One Universe at a Time. I'm Brian Carberline. There are those who believe that life here began out there, perhaps even on Mars. On today's show, we have Dr. Roger Dubey, physicist and director of the Science Exploration Program at the Rochester Institute of Technology. And he's going to talk about the possibilities of life on Mars. One of the things you're looking at right now is a recreation of the Miller experiment. Could you give me an overview of what that actually is?
Sure. So it's the Miller and Urey experiment.
Okay.
Miller was the graduate student and Harold Urey was the professor. His first experiment was done in 1953. And what he did was he postulated that perhaps he could recreate the primordial conditions of early Earth, the ocean, its minerals, the atmospheric components in the right ratio, and even lightning with the evaporation and condensation cycle churning away. And he wanted to see whether or not that process could create amino acids, proteins, long-chain hydrocarbons that could form the basis for life.
Right. So this is sometimes called the origin of life experiment, the abiogenesis experiment.
Or, right. Okay. So they designed this experiment. They ran it for about a week, and they got this purplish liquid at the end of it, which has been affectionately called the primordial soup. Mm-hmm. And indeed, it had all kinds of amino acids and proteins in this mixture after about a week of this process running. Carl Sagan picked up on this experiment some years later and decided that he was going to add the nuance of saying, well, lightning doesn't happen that often. So let's go ahead and take a look at something that's present continuously on the early Earth, which is the ultraviolet light from the sun. So those photons have enough energy that they can actually break molecular bonds, and that allows the molecules now to recombine and form different molecules.
You see that effect in like a plastic lawn furniture where it's left out in the sun and it gets fragile and starts falling apart.
Exactly. Same process. So he modified the experiment. Now he removed the electrical discharge for lightning and replaced it with ultraviolet light. He used long wavelength ultraviolet light, so 350 to about 400 nanometers wavelength. Okay. And he ran the experiment for about a week using the same ratios of the early Earth's atmosphere gases and produced pretty much the same primordial soup. Voila. So that was really kind of cool.
Mm-hmm.
My students are going to be doing is they're going to reproduce the second experiment, the Sagan experiment.
Okay, so the ultraviolet light.
We're going to use ultraviolet light simply because, to be honest, the idea of an arc spark inside a closed atmospheric chamber like that doesn't excite me very much. I just would not like any unexpected events to happen with my students.
Right,
so we are going to not go that way. So we're going to reproduce early Earth using ultraviolet light. Get that experiment running. And then the thing that has not yet been done is to now go to the early conditions on Mars. In about the 4 billion years ago time frame, the Earth and Mars, in fact, all of the solar planets were going through what was called the heavy bombardment age.
That's where lots of meteors and
lots and lots of meteors and asteroids, and basically everything from the formation of the solar system was settling out. And the things that had eccentric orbits were slowly getting, you know, weaned out and collected by the remaining planets. And so the poor planets were getting clobbered all the time. We're picking that time frame. And there's a specific reason that we're doing that. And that is that there's a theory called panspermia.
Right.
And the idea there is that perhaps life originated on Mars, and perhaps with life on the surface of Mars, perhaps an asteroid came in, struck the planet very violently, all sorts of ejecta got sent out into the interplanetary region, and after some period of time, maybe 50, 100,000 years later or longer, one of these asteroids might come down as a meteor on Earth, you know, arrive in the ocean and basically release its amino acids and proteins into the Earth's ocean. And bingo, now you've got the seeding of life on Earth by something that happened on another planet.
Right.
So that's the theory of panspermia. Okay. So what our students...
And we have evidence of meteorites reaching the Earth from
Mars. Oh, yes, so absolutely.
At least that part of it is absolutely true.
That's absolutely true.
Okay.
So, a little bit of a sidetrack here. Last year's experiment, not this Miller experiment, was indeed searching for signs of life on Mars meteorites.
Okay. So you actually got to have a
Mars
meteorite.
So we got seven Mars meteorites in hand. And
fragments are...
They're small pieces.
Okay.
And the first question that I had the students answer was, well, how do we even know these things are from Mars? Very first question, right? It's like, why isn't this just a chunk of rock that somebody picked up in Colorado somewhere? Yep. And the answer is that if you look at the ratio of two isotopes of argon 36 and argon 38, on Earth, that ratio is about 1.2 to 1. And what happens is the heavier isotope gets formed by the bombardment of argon by cosmic rays.
Okay.
Because the Earth has a very thick atmosphere, the cosmic rays are severely attenuated compared to the environment on Mars.
Okay.
They have a very thin atmosphere. And there, the ratio of the same two isotopes is 3.4 to 1.
So we actually know the ratio of argon.
Significantly different.
Yes, and it's very different.
And so all you have to do is take a look at that ratio of those isotopes, and bingo, you can tell whether or not it's Earth-based or if it's Martian.
And because it's argon, it's a noble gas.
It doesn't interact with things.
So it
captures this snapshot, and then you're good to go.
So it's just that easy.
So we were able to validate that ratio with our early Mars rovers. Indeed, 3.4 to 1. It's like, wow, really, really nice
really
stuff.
Really higher, yeah.
Yeah. So going back to Miller and Urey, we are looking at that early Martian environment. I have the students now looking at the atmospheric components and their ratios in that time frame on Mars. I have another group of students looking at the intensity of the solar spectrum on early Mars. So they have to look at the aging of the sun and see how that affects it. They have to worry about the attenuation of the light from the sun by the Martian atmosphere at that time.
It's not just how much sunlight is reaching Mars, but how much is getting through the atmosphere, which is different.
Getting through the atmosphere and at that particular wavelength in particular, because we want to reproduce how much UV was hitting the surface of Mars.
So when you're talking about the difference between the early conditions of Earth and the early conditions of Mars, how do they differ?
There's a huge difference in terms of atmospheric components and their ratios.
Okay.
In that time frame, during the early bombardment period, Mars was about 92% CO2.
Okay.
And the other components, oxygen, nitrogen, water vapor, were way down in this single, maybe couple of percent.
Right. And so then Earth was...
Earth, in complete contrast, was more like 20% oxygen, 20% nitrogen, 20% CO2. So those are really big differences of atmospheric conditions. So it'll be kind of interesting to see whether or not we see the same type of primordial soup being created on early Mars.
Right. It seems like, if I remember the Earth experiment, it was the ammonia and the... The nitrogen compounds as well as the carbon compounds that allowed the amino acids to form. And if you've got mostly CO2, it seemed like it might be very much harder to do.
Right, exactly. But, keep in mind that early Mars, like early Earth, did have active water on the surface. And so that dissolved a lot of the minerals. We know what the mineral content of Mars is now, especially since we have these meteorites in hand. So we can actually reproduce that pretty well.
Okay, so we know pretty well then what the early condition was of Mars and the early condition.
Yeah. Mars was a lot warmer then than it is now. It had a thicker atmosphere then than now. Temperatures on the surface of Mars ranged from about 10 degrees Fahrenheit to probably on the order of 80 degrees or so Fahrenheit.
So it would be livable conditions.
Very human
in terms
livable
of temperature.
Conditions. Yeah. I mean, even now with our rovers, we do see clouds going by on Mars.
Right.
So, it's got this, it's got a lot of the characteristics that we think, wow, that really reminds me of home.
Mm-hmm.
Except the sky is pink and not blue.
Right.
But With all of that, the early Earth conditions, in contrast, Earth was much, much hotter at that time. Temperatures of 110 degrees at the coolest point. I know it's warm now. This has been a warm summer for us.
So basically summer in Texas.
Summer
all year
in Phoenix
round.
Or something like that. And that's kind of like the cool part of the planet.
Right.
And it just
right.
gets hotter
you're
from there
the polar
when you get
region
to the equator.
Like southern Texas.
So those conditions have changed significantly. And of course, with those kinds of temperatures on both planets, there's a lot of thermal activities. There's a lot of other mixing things happening, not just the UV breaking the bonds.
Now, were those warmer temperatures? Was that driven by the sun, or was that because of their atmospheres being thicker? Or
well, actually, there was also it's a whole combination of things, and certainly those two are true. There was also a lot more volcanic activity
on both Earth and Mars.
Okay. That dramatically changed what the planet felt like. We had some serious asteroid hits that basically put a lot of stuff into the atmosphere and gave us more of a greenhouse effect type of thing. We had periods of rapid cooling and then heating back up. The same types of things were experienced on Mars.
So very volatile and rapid changes and everything.
Absolutely, so. Absolutely.
It doesn't sound like a good environment for life.
Right. Well, yeah, certainly not the way we know it now.
Yeah.
But it was perhaps as a crucible of life, it was just really what was needed, and that's what we're trying to investigate.
You're listening to One Universe at a Time. I'm talking to Roger Duby about the possibilities of life on Mars. So you mentioned working with students, and so you have students working on this project. Are these graduate students? Are they undergrads?
So these are actually incoming first-year students.
So these are fresh freshmen.
These are fresh freshmen. They have not completed a single course at RIT when they walk into this project.
You're bold.
But the exciting thing is that suddenly their creative and scientific curiosity is unleashed with all of the facilities that we have available to them. With all of the faculty, staff, and graduate students that are around here, they learn very quickly that they can make tons of progress if they learn how to tap those resources very effectively.
Right. That would seem like a huge challenge, because you're basically taking high school students and putting them on what is a replication of a Nobel Prize-winning experiment.
That's correct. That's right. And as I say, none of them have taken a complete RIT course yet. They don't walk in with a pre-existing knowledge of organic chemistry or physical chemistry or any of those types of things. They don't have a good feeling for even the imaging science part of the experiments.
Are these majors? Are they chemistry majors or physics majors? Or
this particular class, science exploration, is for students who are interested in the sciences or mathematics, but they haven't chosen a major yet. So these are undeclared students coming into RIT.
They like science, but they don't know
what. They love science, but they're not sure what.
So they've had science in high school.
Right.
But they don't know what to commit to or if they want to commit to.
What I try to do in this course is expose them to what real science is like. Here's the goal. Now you have to tell me how you're going to get there.
Right.
And I will provide the support, I'll provide the equipment, the instrumentation, I'll make suggestions, maybe you should go speak with this professor of astrophysics, etc. But by and large, I want them to learn how to direct research as a group.
So they're developing their own program in terms of how to carry this out.
Their own program.
So you say, okay, we want to do this experiment.
That's correct.
And go forth.
Right.
And you're just kind
there
of as a mentor.
And I'm there to make sure that, you know, they don't do anything crazy, that they stay within some reasonable bounds.
Right.
I do make suggestions from time to time, but I try not to do that too much because it interferes with the creative process. I want them to really learn how to work together, how to organize a project as part of the team, and how to take responsibility for what each of the groups does in contributing to the whole project, because it's a multifaceted project.
So how many years have you done this?
So we've done this now. This is our fourth year as in this incarnation of science exploration.
Okay.
Previously, it had been kind of a survey course where, you know, we would bring in speakers. They would talk about their research in this field and that field. So they'd learn
someday
about,
you too may do
right,
this.
This is what biology is like. This is what astronomy is like, and so on. And so they'd get to hear and engage these professors and researchers but there was no hands-on component.
Right.
And I'm an experimentalist, and so I sort of look at the world as like, I want to be able to actually do something.
If I can't put my hands on it, it's not real.
That's right. So I wanted to create an environment where they would have that opportunity to really get involved if they so chose. If they find that they just can't stand literally getting their hands dirty, maybe they can do the calculations.
Okay.
You know, maybe they're more comfortable with that. I mean, there are, you know, two classes of scientists. There are theorists and there are experimentalists.
Right.
And both of them are perfectly valid. And it really depends on the nature of the person to sort of discover, gee, I really like the theory, or I really like building things. You know, mm-hmm. And they have to discover that about themselves. Then they have to discover which of the many aspects of science within the College of Science and mathematics really excite them, the things that they feel really engaged about. And that's what the course tries to offer. I choose projects that are multifaceted and preferably touching on all of the sciences.
Right, so a thing like this one that would go into chemistry and physics and imaging science, mm-hmm. computer modeling, all of those types
of things. Yeah,
okay.
That's absolutely right.
So about how many students are working on this?
So this year we have 18 students in the class. The number kind of goes up and down. What's happening is that there's some networking going on, and sort of the word is getting out that this is a really interesting course.
I'll sign up.
I give these presentations where I talk about this program to prospective students and their parents, and the majority of the comments that I get afterwards are from the parents saying, I really want to come back to college and take this course.
Right, right.
Because it's exactly the way I would have loved to do it as an undergrad myself.
Right.
To have that opportunity.
Well, just to jump right in.
To jump right in, absolutely. Right. And you learn things by necessity rather than by program. So it's not rote. It's not, you know, at the end of this course, you'll understand what quantum mechanics is. Rather, they have to get in there and sort of, you know, do some studying about quantum mechanics right away so that they understand how photons interact with matter and how they might break those chemical bonds.
Right.
As opposed to taking the entire quantum mechanics.
So it's not comprehensive in the sense that
it's not, but
they're getting a very specific thing in that area, which is a lot like how we do research.
It's just in time learning. Absolutely. Right. And the other thing that's really fun about this type of approach is that the students get to experience surprises and they get to experience disappointment. Mm-hmm. You know, gee, I really thought we were going to find this and it didn't happen that way. My experiment didn't work the way I thought it was going to work. But then, you know, they have to learn critical thinking. What exactly did the experiment do? How could it have done that? What is that telling you? It's telling you something about an underlying process where you perhaps had made some assumptions that aren't quite right.
Mm-hmm.
So what are you learning from this? And they sort of learn that process, again, in a very hands-on sort of way.
Right. So whether the experiment is a success, quote unquote, or a failure doesn't matter,
right?
Because you're focused on giving the experience for the students.
Correct.
You know, sometimes a failure is a success.
The success here is the students being engaged and learning how to think critically. The specifics of, you know, gee, did you make anything that was whiz bang at the end is secondary. Obviously, we want them to succeed, and you know, in years past, we've had some very nice successes with this class. But that's not really what I'm looking for. I'm just giving them something really juicy to bite into, you know, the ultimate cheeseburger.
That's right. And then they can actually go and explore that.
Exactly.
So that sounds like a huge challenge.
Yeah.
This is One Universe at a Time. We're talking with Roger Dubey about the origins of life on Mars. Obviously, you want to be a success with this. I mean, mm-hmm. Yuri. Miller and Urey wanted to be a success. This is always one of those big questions. It's like the Big Bang or evolution or anything like that. This idea of abiogenesis, the arisal of life from inanimate stuff. I guess one of the questions I would have is, why do we explore this? What do we want to find from this?
We're really trying to extend our understanding of who we are, why we're here, and how we got here. And there are many different ways to tackle